I can't tell you how great it is to have you on. And
well,
I
heard, thank you.
And we were talking earlier, John Madden, your old partner, getting into the Hall of Fame, and how many people of this generation don't realize he was an NFL head coach. They always associate him with the broadcaster and the video games. And
he's actually the youngest head coach who ever achieved 100 wins.
Yeah, that's right.
In his career.
And I don't know how many people realize, especially of our generation, you weren't too bad of a football player yourself.
Well, I played.
and of course, early on in the book, you talk about your NFL career, and of
right.
course, going from, I guess you came up with the Lions. Is that right?
I was drafted by the Lions. I never really played for the Lions. But I was there, and I went through training camp with the Lions. And then while I was at the All-Star game, the college All-Star game used to be a big deal. And while I was there, I was traded to the Cardinals because they didn't have a kicker. And I could play. I played defensive end and offensive end, and I was a kicker. So,
and then
while I was at the training camp, at the All-Star game training camp, I was traded.
And then, of course, after several years with the Cardinals, correct me if I'm wrong, the Chicago Cardinals.
That's correct.
And then talk about the dream. You go to the New York Giants.
New York football Giants.
The football Giants, where
yes.
Star-studded at that point in time. That was the marquee team in the NFL in the late 50s.
Yeah, that was the team that really got the attention of the American country. I mean, the games that we played and being in New York and playing at Yankee Stadium, it was a magic time to be in New York. It really was.
You talk about in your book, and of course you were the kicker which aren't around anymore, the straight on kicker. You had the
right.
flat-toed shoe, but
right.
you look at today's NFL games, the artificial surfaces, the groomed fields. You talk about in your book, Summerall, on and off the air, what it was like kicking in Yankee Stadium with painted dirt and how hard it really was to kick a football.
Well, it was like playing out of the rough in golf every time you kicked, because you never were sure what kind of hold you were going to get, what kind of lie you were going to get. Many times we played on baseball infields, I think they do, and still in some stadiums.
Oh yeah,
but without putting the turf on them, and it was just a hit and miss situation. The percentages of success as far as field goal kickers was much lower at that time. Now I think if you don't kick in the 80% percentile, you're not accepted. You don't have a job. Then if you were 60%, you were very, very good.
Why, and kicking in the style, I mean, nobody ever heard of the soccer style kicking,
right.
but I was looking at your stats from when you were playing. I guess 59 was your best year. I mean, you didn't miss an extra point.
I didn't miss an extra point while I was with the Giants, I think.
Wow.
That was there 4 years. So I quit with a streak intact. I don't know how long it was.
You know, and before we get into the broadcasting stuff, but and switching over to broadcasting, 1958, the famous game between the mm-hmm. Giants and the Colts. Were you guys aware on the field, a phenomenal game, first sudden death game? You guys were making history as far as the NFL was concerned, or was it just another game? Let's get this win. Let's win a title.
Absolutely unaware. In fact, I was sitting next to our captain, Kyle Rote, on the bench.
Sure.
When the game went into overtime, and I said, "What happens now?" And he said, "I'm not sure, but I think we got to play some more."
And, yeah, you guys didn't know. I mean, it never happened.
No, we didn't have any idea that we were going into overtime. If procedures go as they're supposed to, it takes 2 or 3 minutes before the overtime period, because you have to go out for another coin toss, which we did. But it must have been 15 or 20 minutes before we started to play in the overtime period, because the NBC, who was broadcasting the game, had torn down their equipment they'd already begun to tear down. And they had to reconnect everything, and we had to wait until the coin toss and everybody got together and everybody was sure what was happening before we even started to play again.
Wow. And, you know, and it goes into the book, and I have to jump around a little bit because of time, but it jumps around in the you talk about in the book – of how you got your start into broadcasting. And
right.
I want to touch on it very briefly. I guess you were offered an audition where a lot of the other marquee giant players were doing radio shows and auditioning for things. And I guess Frank Gifford already had his own deal. He was doing his own thing. And you went
right.
in and basically auditioned. They liked you, and you had your first radio gig.
That's exactly right. That's the way it happened. They actually were not calling for me. They were calling for my roommate, and he was in the shower. And I answered the phone, and the guy said, just before I hung up the phone, what are you doing this afternoon? Why don't you come along and do the audition? So I went, tagged along. I wasn't one of the original three or four, but after he heard me to answer the phone, he said, why don't you come along? So I went, and they liked the way I sounded, I guess, and I was hired by CBS.
And, of course, when you first started broadcasting, I know you did some early Super Bowl games with, of course, Jack Buck. Mm-hmm. You were the color guy. Who was the main guy in CBS at that time? He quit because he didn't get the Super Bowl.
Ray Scott,
who was a legendary voice as far
right.
as CBS would go.
Right.
And he quit because he didn't get a Super Bowl. And that's kind of like how you continued, because you did color commentary with him, too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, for 6.5 years. Yeah.
And
he was great to work with. He was a great teacher.
But I'm reading the stories in the book. You look back now after what has gone on with your life, with going to mm-hmm. the Betty Ford and having the liver transplant. And thank God that you're still healthy and doing well. But you and Tom Brookshire were the number one broadcast team, at least when I was a kid in the 70s. Used to
right.
love you guys because you two were naturals and you genuinely liked each other.
And we had a good time.
Yes, you did.
We were, that was part of the problem, I think. We had too good a time off the field, out of the booth. And that's why they broke us up, and I went with John Madden, and Tom started to do play-by-play for a brief period himself.
Tell me, and if it's my imagination, did I read it in the book, or is it just memory from when I was watching you guys? First of all, Tom Brookshire was one hell of a football player for the Eagles.
Oh, yeah, he was tough.
And was a mean guy. Is it my imagination, or do I remember you guys as a kid and Tom Brookshire in the booth with a cast on his hand? Didn't he break his hand or something? And I know he played in the NFL with a cast on his hand.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the
reason he quit playing was he broke his leg against the Chicago Bears when the Eagles were playing in Chicago. That's why he quit playing. He actually started broadcasting while he was in the hospital.
Really?
They came into the hospital, CBS in Philadelphia did, and he did a weekly show from his hospital bed. And that's how he got started in broadcasting.
You have to tell Pat, we're with Pat Summerall, by the way, his book On and Off the Air, available in bookstores now because I've seen it. You got to tell the story, and I don't know if you can tell it as well as you say it in the book. You were going from Washington doing a game on Saturday to Philadelphia to do a Sunday game.
Right.
And you and Brookshire got into some kind of drinking competition with the crew in the van, and Brookshire wound up tied to the front of the van.
Well, it was his idea. He said, let's make it look like we had to go meet with the Eagles and their coaching staff and their players when we got to Philadelphia, when we were driving from Washington to Philadelphia. And after the drinking contest, which we won handily, Brookie said, I tell you what, he said, let's go meet the Eagles. And why don't we tie me to the front of the van like we've been on a deer hunt? And we thought that sounded like a heck of an idea, so that's the way we arrived to meet the Philadelphia Eagles.
And how did the Eagles take that?
They just shook their head and walked away.
And you say in the book, and there's a million stories like this, you say in the book, and it's kind of like it is in radio, and at least a few years ago it was, that CBS, when you guys were going around and you were having fun, they at first thought they were amused by you two guys. And
for a while, yeah.
Yeah, and then they realized, we either need to break you up or you're going to kill each other.
That's exactly what they said, and they were probably right.
I mean, obviously not all the stories, because probably some you want to keep out of the book. Tell mm-hmm. one more story that I want you to talk about, if you can. It's in the book. You were in New York at a piano bar, and it was a piano player that had a toupee on, and Brookshire jumped and swiped the hair. What happened?
Well, he said to me, the two of us were sitting there, and he said to me, and I knew when he called me Patrick, that trouble was imminent, and I should have known better. And he said to me, the guy playing the piano, who was over kind of, it was a circular saloon, and he was over in the middle of the circle, and he said, the guy wearing the guy playing the piano is wearing a toupee. And I don't know why that angered him, but it did. And all of a sudden, he leapt across the bar and onto the piano and grabbed the guy's toupee and waved it around and said, see, I told you so. And a little bit later, we were walking back to the hotel, and I looked at Rookie, who was standing next to me. We were crossing, I think, Madison Avenue in New York, and I looked, and he still had the guy's toupee in his hand. He got his scalp that night.
I'll save it for the book, but true or false, you and Brookie actually brought a horse into a hotel.
Well, we made that attempt. We were not successful.
I'm gonna one-up you here, Pat, because okay. Haney and I, during a broadcast, actually brought a horse through the radio station.
Well, we weren't successful, but we tried.
Let me tell you something. You were on the right track, because when you are successful, it is something to behold, people's reactions.
Oh, but you know what? And that's the thing. Because of your success, you guys got away with an awful lot. Oh, that's just Summerall and Brookshire. And these guys are great. Didn't you actually, there was a picture of you two laughing hysterically, and you used it as a Christmas card.
That's correct.
Now,
yes, we did.
Of course, many, many years with John Madden. And
22.
You had a story in your book. I mean, it well known now that Madden, afraid of heights, didn't like to fly. That's one of the reasons why he got out of coaching. He couldn't handle the travel with the team and being in the jet. You have a story, and I think there's even a picture in the book where the two of you are doing a two shot. And he was afraid of heights, and you guys were up high, and you had to like cut away to go and grab some paperwork or something to do the next shot, and he's standing by himself. And didn't you say in the book that he was like afraid he was going to fall over and go down the second level?
The first game we did together in the old stadium in Tampa, and he was sweating. I thought, my gosh, this is not the right business for him, because he's not very comfortable, and he was just wet with sweat. And I thought it was because he was nervous about being on television, but actually it was the fear of the height. And the fact that it was sort of a temporary booth in the old stadium in Tampa, and it was a little rickety, and it was high up over the upper deck in the stands, and he was just uncomfortable with that.
And he really...
Well, plenty of people were uncomfortable in the old sombrero.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, so many years of covering the Masters golf tournament. I mean, you, tennis, golf... And of course, you talk about in your book when you know, you finally checked into the Betty Ford clinic. Mm-hmm. I know you can talk about it now. What was the straw for you that broke the camel's back and said, I need to go and take care of this problem, or I'm going to die?
Well, there were a lot of people in that intervention meeting, 15 to be exact. Friends of mine and people of influence and people that I, in some cases, was afraid of. And they had gotten together, a group, and they had written letters to me saying that they thought I needed to make a change, and how much they cared for me and how much they regretted seeing me do the things that they had seen me done that I didn't necessarily remember. But I think that the letter that made me decide to go and made me admit to myself maybe that I needed help and needed some guidance was a letter that somebody read from my oldest child, my daughter, in which she said, among other things, lately when we've been out in social situations, I've been ashamed that we share the same last name.
Wow.
And that sort of got my attention and thought, made me think, well, maybe I do need to go somewhere for some guidance and some help. And thank goodness I did. Saved my life.
And with the liver transplant, I remember, and it was a few years ago, you were on one of the news shows. Was it 60 Minutes? And you were talking about how your liver had completely shut down and the water weight that was on you, and you were very close to death. You had to get that liver transplant.
18 hours, they told me I had to live if I didn't get a liver transplant, yes. And it was, I don't know how much water they took off of me, but I weighed 320 pounds. I normally weigh about 100 pounds less than that. But I was just so full of fluid and couldn't get rid of the fluid that they put me on dialysis to get it before they could ever attempt the transplant. But I tell you what, I'll tell you this. When I checked into the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, I was really, really sick, close to death. But when they put me in the bed in the Mayo Clinic, one of the nurses said to me, this room just became available because Billy Graham just checked out. So I figured I had a chance.
Yeah, exactly. You also mentioned it because of the New York scene. You were very good friends and were there with Mickey Mantle going through his problems, too. I mean, he, too, had to go and have the liver transplant. Give us some memories of Mickey and what he was like.
Well, I met him when he and I were both teenagers. We were playing minor league baseball in Oklahoma. He was playing for another team, and his two twin brothers, not his twins, but he had brothers who were twins, were on the same team that I was on, Roy and Ray. So that's how I got to know the Mantles in the beginning. And then, of course, when I went to the Giants, he was still playing with the Yankees, and we used their locker room, and I happened to get his locker. So we remained friends, and then after that, when I moved to Dallas and he was already in Dallas, we became fast friends and played a lot of golf together. And being around Mickey, with Mickey, particularly in New York, was like being with what a rock star must go through, because sure, he was adored, such adoration and such, you know, people just looked at him like he was some sort of a religious saint or something like that. And that attention bothered him. He never was comfortable with that because he was just the same guy that he always was when he was in Oklahoma. He was just a good old country boy.
Now, when back in your drinking days and his drinking days, did you guys ever go out and hoop it up like you and Brookshire?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Many times. We sure did. Many times.
I have to ask you this. I mean, when you talk about your life and the alcohol abuse, and you talk in the book about, you know, hangovers, and did you ever go on the air under the influence?
No, I don't think so. I may have been feeling bad, but I don't think I ever did. And I never thought it affected my work. I'm sure it did. I know it affected my morals. I know it affected my honesty. I became a very good liar during those years, and that's the only thing that I think I got better at was lying. But, you know, I told myself that I never had a hangover. I never felt bad. I think that was just something that I told myself, but never on the air, no.
But the time that this was going on, and I think maybe people lose sight of this, society was different. It was a lot more accepted, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know that our behavior was accepted, but acceptable, I should say. But it was much more tolerant, yes.
Yeah, exactly, and how times have changed for the good, I guess, in that area. Let me ask you this. You came back for a brief time with ESPN in 2004 when their play-by-play guy had to have some heart surgery. You did some preseason games, some regular season games.
Right.
Do you miss it? Wouldn't you like to have worked some kind of deal with CBS or NBC or Fox and just say, let me do one game a month? One game a month. Let me go. Give me something that's near my home. Let me do a game.
Well, I'd love to do that. That would be a great arrangement. I think that that's a possibility, in fact.
I would love to have you
back on
the air.
To answer your question, I miss it, and I miss it a lot. I don't miss the traveling, but the camaraderie and the being around the game and getting to talk with the players and the coaches and the preparation and the game itself, yes, I miss very much.
Because I know they did that with Keith Jackson with college football,
right,
over on ABC. He said, you know,
right,
what, I'm done. I want to retire. They said, go out, do the USC games, and just, at your convenience, just handle the West Coast games. You're not the national guy anymore, but you
right,
still get a chance to do it. I would love that.
Well, I would love that, too.
All right, we'll make a few calls, all right?
Okay. I'd appreciate it.
And you've reached that that rare status in life where just your voice, you've been so many places in people's lives without ever knowing them, and just the sound of your voice means it's time for football. And, I mean, memories of your voice go all the way back from being a kid, Thanksgiving, just any time. And it was all you were always happy to hear Pat Summerall's voice because you knew you had a good game coming up.
I can't tell you how many times when I'm out speaking or I go somewhere, when people have those memories, they say to me, how about saying just one time, you'll see 60 Minutes in its entirety except on the West Coast, followed by Murder, She Wrote.
It's so true because your voice alone brings back family time, holidays, a time when you're with your friends. I urge everybody to go out and get Pat's book. It's Summerall, On and Off the Air. Ladies and gentlemen, Pat Summerall, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Bye. Have a good day.
Bye, Pat.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.